Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast. I'm Aaron Syme, host, and the Scaling Tech Podcast, as always, is brought to you by AgilityFeed.com, providers of technical staffing and software development services in Latin America for clients globally. In today's episode, I'm joined by my guest, Anna J. McDougall. Anna is an award-winning engineering leader, TEDx speaker, and author of the Amazon best-selling career guide, You Belong in Tech. As a software engineering manager at Hello Better, Anna and her team have successfully implemented the interview methods that we'll discuss today, cutting hiring timelines while improving candidate quality and team satisfaction. Today, we're going to talk about the right way to encourage AI in tech interviews. And this conversation will be based in part on an excellent Medium article she wrote entitled, where is it? Oh, I had it on the screen. There it is. You cannot outrun AI in tech interviews, so we designed around it. So thank you so much, Anna, for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really thrilled to be here.
It's a pleasure having you join me today. This is a really important topic for sure. I know a lot of people are interested in and affected by, positively or negatively. I'd say mainly negatively. But hopefully we can turn that around, right? We can improve that today. So before we dive into those details, first I want to remind anyone watching us live, you can ask a question in the comments anytime and we'll address it. And thank you also to those of you joining us on a replay of this event. But before we go into the details of your interview method, let's start with the big picture first. How have AI tools disrupted conventional interview methods, and what challenges does that present for hiring managers?
So we're starting with something
small question.
Yeah. also, I want to apologize to people, anyone who's watching. My camera is deciding to like focus and unfocus itself. So if you see me waving wildly at the camera, it's a focus issue. Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to AI tools. All right. So there are a variety of ways. The first is, of course, the classic kind of ChatGPT style, ask a question about the code, get a response. So people could, of course, for example, in a take home, a classic take home assignment, they could quite easily kind of ask those questions, get that feedback. They don't really need to do it that way anymore because of AI agents, you know, embedded in the IDEs. So that's not really like a thing so much anymore, but those kind of traditional conversational LLM styles can still be used with these tools that have made a lot of press lately about, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but a university student who created a tool so people could cheat in live coding assignments so that it will kind of give them the good leet code style responses that they could pull up instantaneously. And weirdly, so we've got kind of like leet code, take home assignments, they're being impacted. The other one that's been very, very public or very popular to talk about is the AI deepfakes for the actual faces. So people actually taking technical tests for other people and kind of having an AI superimpose, I would suppose you would say, the person's face on so they can just get the job. And of course, you know, we can go even further. We can say there are some bad actors out there who are also like trying to find their way into big tech companies, especially in the States or in Europe, so as to get access to their systems and actually, you know, do some sort of hacking exercise. I'm not really so much in security, but, you know, to gain access to their systems. The weirdest one, you know, on top of those, is the one for me where you actually have a conversational AI helping you with like soft skills questions. So we've got to admit that not every engineer actually has a problem with the technical side of things. Sometimes their problem is actually with the soft skills. and so there are also situations, of course, where people will use AI tools in order to kind of help them answer like, what hobbies do you have? Which, you know, I find very funny, but okay, you know, like there are lots of different ways people are using AI tools now.
Right. Absolutely. I hadn't thought about the soft skills angle on that for sure. That's an interesting one. Yeah. There's so many different layers of how this can change the way people abuse the interview process or try and take advantage of it or you know, maybe more innocently just trying to give themselves a leg up in some situations too, in a competitive market. So but it definitely affects, you know, how we do interviews and how people conduct and attend interviews. But before we go into that more, I want to start, I want to hear a little bit about your journey, what led you to focus on hiring practices, and how did your own experiences as an engineering manager and in tech shape your views on technical interviews?
Yeah, sure. So I, in terms of my story, so to speak, I started in tech at a very young age. You know, I was aged 8. I was making HTML websites with Notepad on GeoCities or AngelFire and uploading things on FTP. And, you know, there was no CSS, there was no JavaScript. Everything was done with iframes. Iframes were like amazing. And image maps. I don't know if you remember, but image maps used to be the hot thing where you would like have one image, but then you could actually map where the links were in it. That was like the hot stuff back then. So I started early. I suppose like many girls who were interested in tech, I didn't pursue it in large part because I didn't feel so welcome at the time. You know, this was, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. There was maybe not as much awareness about the topic of inclusion of people. And I had other things I was good at. So I actually went into digital communications. I learned mostly journalism actually, but ended up going more in the direction of marketing, online marketing, digital marketing. From there in my, about 6 years ago, I kind of rediscovered tech. You know, I knew there was a high demand for software engineers. I thought, you know, I used to code when I was a kid. I learned Visual Basic at school. Like, let's see what the kids are up to nowadays. And discovered JavaScript, and you know, the rest is history. So from there, I was working as a team lead. So I got a job as an engineer, of course, but then I quickly went into more of the team lead management side of things. I think, you know, because the reason that this ends up like pushing into having such a strong interest in hiring practices and in technical interviews is because, you know, I was really thinking a lot about this topic of like, firstly, how do we really assess skills? Because I was an example of someone who, like, yes, has a natural affinity for the technical side. And so I was very lucky in that sense. I didn't have to worry about that so much. But I also had a lot of other skills that built me into a good engineer. So I've always had a big interest in, like, how do we actually get to the heart of, like, what we need in an organization, and the fact that that changes, you know, that it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Like, I'm quite obviously a big old extrovert. But not, you don't want a team full of extroverts, right? Like that would be horrible. but similarly, when you have a team that's full of just introverts, you also end up having some problems sometimes in terms of like communication things or in terms of like, you know, cross-functional kind of initiatives. So I guess like from that side, I've always been interested in the combination of like, how do teams really work? And like using that business perspective that I got through my marketing and project management career, and kind of bringing those ideas then into tech and saying like, okay, how do we actually design a system? You can kind of see it like hacking the interview process, you know?
Right.
Like how do I actually look at this system and break it down and look at what are actually our goals with building an interview system? Like what are we actually looking for when we're hiring? How do we know what we're looking for? And how do we assess technical skills then in an age where all of these new tools are coming out? But also how do we take that as a factor in when we're hiring someone and not the factor when we're hiring someone? Because I do think you need to look at every candidate holistically, and you also need to look at your own teams holistically and even your whole company holistically and think, where are our gaps? What are we missing here? Like if we just go down the road of technical excellence alone, you're going to end up missing out on a lot of things that could bring innovation, that could drive motivation, you know, and other things that help teams stay together and help businesses be successful. So I think that answers your question where it comes from. But overall, I guess I like with code, I view these kinds of systems as things that can be engineered and can be structured to solve problems. And that's kind of where I came from. When we at Hello Better, which is my current company where I'm working as an engineering manager, when we decided to change the interview process, these were some of the questions that I was kind of trying to ask and answer. And then the technical interview was just one part of that, but it's a very important part. And so that's why I saw it as a place where we could do something a bit interesting and do something a bit different. And yeah, that was the idea.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a lot of interesting points there that go beyond the technical aspect and beyond the role of AI, perhaps, too, in these interviews that, you know, in the past, we've always had to consider, and we still need to consider, you know, how, not, as you said, not just does this person have the right technical skills that we need in the team, but are they a good fit in our team? And like the difference between, you know, one example of that, introverts and extroverts, right? If you have a team that is primarily introverts now, for example, you may specifically want someone who's a little more extroverted to help shake things up a little bit, right? Because it is helpful to have a balance of kind of different personality types, different perspectives, you know, all sorts of things, right? And so we've had to consider that in the past and consider, okay, even if they pass the technical aspects really well, are they someone who's going to fit well in the way that our team works? And you know, so there's all sorts of considerations there. And now on top of that, we don't even know perhaps if they're actually passing the technical interview themselves. But then there's this other problem of, well, maybe, you know, if they're really good at using AI, they're going to use that in their job too. So how, you know, there's so many things to consider here, right? And so I guess I want to, you know, let's talk a little bit about kind of the candidate behavior first about how are, you know, in a software development interview, how, or maybe more broadly, if you like, but how are people using tools like ChatGPT, GitHub Copilot, whatever, to appear more qualified than they really are in interviews? What are some of the mechanics of how that's working? That you
in the physical mechanics, I mean, as we'll get into soon, but it's not something that we at Hello Better have to deal with at the moment to kind of sniff out anymore, I suppose. But what I've heard of primarily is people, for example, they will have another laptop or another mobile phone or something like that positioned actually like in front of their screen. So they can still share their screen with you and you won't see anything, but they can see something right in front of them that is kind of giving them the answers or feeding them the answers. Of course, I think there are some signs, you know, there are some things. I mean, if someone's face looks really strange, like the classic test is, you know, to get them to do this, like to, for those who are just listening, to kind of hold your hands, fingers apart and wave your hand in front of your face to see if there are kind of like any illusions being broken there. So that's one thing. The other is, of course, someone who's continuously looking off screen. So for those who are watching the video, maybe I'm kind of doing that as I'm talking to Aaron and, you know, that's all looking down a little bit like that. You can kind of see the flicking or even like the eyes kind of scanning things. Yeah, but of course, part of why we designed this new interview process was so that we don't have to worry about that. I mean, obviously the face thing is still a concern, but we haven't personally come across many of those. But, you know, they're out in the wild. It's just something more to be aware of, I think, than anything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, the technology is always changing. So there's always going to be more innovative, you know, ways of doing this. I mean, one of the interesting things that we've run into in interviewing candidates in my software development companies, Agility Feed and WebRTC Ventures. In a WebRTC Ventures group, we work with a lot of voice and video AI as part of our work. So it's interesting to us when we've seen someone who appears to be they're keeping their eyes on the camera. They're doing a good job of that. But part of the way that they're doing that is because they're using like a voice-based LLM on a different screen, and they're listening to a response from that so that they're still getting coached by an LLM that's, say, listening to me talk to them, convert that to text, feed that to the LLM, convert that back to audio, put it back in the candidate's ear, right? So on the one hand, hey, great job for putting together an interesting technical pipeline. So in a way, you're showing us some good skills there, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's, you know, it still feels like something that's cheating, right? And so there's lots of different ways that this can be done. And I mean, what do you see as the cost to companies when they accidentally hire someone through a kind of a deceptive process like this without realizing it?
I guess it depends on the person. You know, as you said, some people do this kind of cheating because I'll call it cheating because, you know, if they're being dishonest about it in this case. They do this kind of cheating because they get very nervous in interviews or because they know they could do the task normally, but in the interview pressure, they they feel like they're going to flub it. So it could be that someone is cheating in your AI, in your interview with AI, and actually they're a great engineer and you've got no problem on your hands whatsoever.
Right.
You know, they might just feel that they need that extra assistance to get there. But of course, like, worst case scenario is different. And in many cases, you know, it won't be an honest representation of where that person is at, or the person will be mis-leveled. You know, that's the other thing. Maybe the person is an okay mid-level right. engineer, but they've been hired as a senior engineer, and that will, I think, very quickly reveal itself. Of course, the worst thing a business can lose is time and money. And I think you lose both when you make bad hires. You know, you usually have to start the process over again. If there's a recruiter involved, you have to, you know, pay more fees or whatever to find this person again. You might have the same situation happen again. You know, people start freaking out. You start thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? I've hired in this way for decades. Why is it not working anymore? You know, I think that's part of why I came up with this new system and why I decided to write about it as well, and why I decided to share it with the community, because I just kept seeing so much panic over, like, you know, this isn't working anymore, and how can I trust take-home tests anymore, and how can I do LEAP code when they could have this new tool installed on their computer? You know, like, I saw a lot of that and I thought, well, you don't need to worry that much. Like, let's just take a bit of pressure off. We just need to update how we think about technical interviews and how we do the process. You know, we're not, you know, this is something I said in the blog post, but I'll say it again here. I think a lot of businesses are stuck in the same mentality as when they were junior engineers, you know, starting out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, you know, were doing a technical interview on a whiteboard in a room, in an office, you know. they either weren't laptops, or laptops were too expensive to be having right. in a technical interview, you know. And so they've still got this in their head, this is the best way to assess talent. And yeah. the simple fact is that the tools are different now. So yeah. the tools are different now. We are not in that time. We are not in an office. We're not in a controlled environment anymore. So you can either, I suppose, go back to pulling people into offices and making them stand in front of a whiteboard, which luckily I don't hear a lot about nowadays.
Right.
Or you can rethink, okay, what are AI tools and what are they
yeah. for? Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to dive into your recommendations for interview techniques in just a moment. We have a couple of comments I want to get to first from viewers. So Andre says, commented, you know, talk about having a candidate who asked for a moment to organize his desk when he moved on to technical questions. And he, Andres, was able to actually see that he placed his phone under the screen, didn't realize that that was in view of the other camera. So yeah, another, attempt to deceive, let's say, yes. caught, captured there. But Andres also has a question. How do you train interviewers, not, you know, the person conducting yes. the interview, to fairly assess a candidate when AI is allowed or not? So, mm-hmm. you know, how do you keep bias from entering in that? I mean, it's mm-hmm. a problem in interviews in general.
I mean, it's a problem in humanity in general. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't think we're going to solve it in this conversation, I'm sorry to say. But right. But yeah, there are a lot of ways. I mean, for me, I just talk to them. So when I know that, so in our case, it's quite easy because we're quite a small company, that, like, you know, when we know that a new position is opening up, we know that there are about four people who are going to be part of the technical interview process. So I can literally pull them into a room, you know, a Zoom call or a Google Meet or whatever, and actually train them myself. So the blog post that we've been speaking about goes through also how I did that with them. So we actually developed the system ourselves, like with a collection of volunteers from the engineers. And then once we had that framework, I then created a specific training document for the position that we were hiring for most recently, for example. And for that, I pulled in the mobile developers and said, here's the position we're hiring for. Here's how it will work with the new structure. And then on the suggestion of our recruiter. She also had some good documents on bias, like regular kind of different biases that people can have, you know, not just the typical like race, sex, sexuality, religion stuff, but also like, okay, you see someone's gone to a good school and you instantly think, oh, okay, they're going to be good, you know, right. Or someone's gone to a bad school and you instantly think, oh, okay, they're not going to be very good. Or someone's late to a meeting and you think, okay, they're probably not a good candidate, but maybe they're just late to that meeting. You know what I mean? It doesn't right. actually say anything about their skills. So we also kind of went into depth on that as well. One of the big changes that we had to make with our new process was to emphasize to the engineers that the technical round is part of the whole. So this is part of this holistic thing that I mentioned to you earlier, where we said, okay, you actually, it's not a pass-fail thing in our case. We already have an idea based on the first two rounds, that's the screening interview and the hiring manager interview, of like what we think, like who we think is strong in what sense, or who we think is weak in what sense, or, you know, where do we have questions that we need answering. The technical interview for us is to give us a bigger picture of that candidate. If the person is 10 out of 10 on the technical round, but everything else just doesn't quite feel right, or it just doesn't quite fit right, or they're like, what motivates them isn't something we can offer them, or, you know, we know we have a highly sociable team and they like working alone or something like that, then we'll kind of go, okay, like, good to have this information, and maybe for the next position they'll be perfect, but for this one, the 10 out of 10, it doesn't, like, it's not going to be the deciding factor. But we might have someone else who's a 7 or an 8 out of 10, like, I'm saying random numbers, but and maybe they tick every other box. And as the hiring manager, it's my job to decide, is it worth that payoff? Like, is that everything else about them and the not quite perfect technical round, is that worth the balance of, which one on average, or which one in my mind is the safer bet to take? And that's kind of my call. So in terms of training the engineers, we also had to train them to say, look, you might find the perfect candidate from your perspective, but that doesn't actually mean they're the perfect candidate overall, and vice versa. You might advise against someone because you think they're not quite up to scratch, but we might be willing to offer them a junior position instead, or something like that, and you just don't know that. So, you know, there has to be that understanding that they're part of the whole picture there.
Absolutely. One other quick question here. Pedro says, I'm concerned that people, especially developers, are taking advantage of AI tools to get hired not only in one full-time job, but in two or even more. Any recommendations on how to prevent this? I have seen somewhat similar things here where people either they believe they can do more than one job because they think that using AI tools is going to help them churn out more code, or even before AI tools, I've seen people, where situations where someone has tried to do this, where they have tried to farm out the work for their job to other people and try to take advantage of a remote first environment in that sense. So,
I've seen that too. And there's actually a subreddit for anyone who's interested in Reddit or on there. I think it's called Overemployed. And it's this exactly this. It's like people who do this and they all talk to each other. It's very interesting reading for anyone who's who's in the field. not my own personal thing. It sounds very stressful to me. I think in the end, Pedro, you know, you're asking here any recommendations on how to prevent this. I would say, like, create a system and there will always be someone who wants to break it. So, like, I don't know if you can. And that's kind of like the hard truth about it. Like, you can look out for signs of it. You can look out for signs of underperformance, or like people who are, you know, never contributing anything in meetings. Like, for example, they're joining a meeting, but their camera and microphone are off the entire time. I mean, once or twice, you know, if they have a good reason, that can happen. But if that's happening a lot, that might be a sign that they're actually in two meetings, you know? So, there are signs you can look out for, but it has to really be addressed on an individual basis, you know, unless you get to the point of like tracking tax file numbers or something along those lines. But I don't think we're at that level of surveillance just yet. So, you know, let's see how the future pans out. But But yeah, in general, I would say it's good to be aware of it as a risk factor. And I think it's good that you've raised it, especially because AI does make it a bit easier. I would say, especially for companies that are less tech forward. A lot of conversations that we have, a lot of the people who, you know, will be joining us here, you know, their engineering managers or tech leads or CTOs or whatever are very tech forward companies. You know, they want to be on the edge of what's happening. And so they'll be very aware of these things. But you've got to remember, like, you've got a lot of software engineering departments that are in old school banks, you know, that are in, like, I don't know, car brands, like places where the overall company is not as aware of what is happening technically in software engineering. And so there are a lot of places where people can get away with this quite easily. So it is good to raise awareness of it, I think, just to look out for it on an individual level. But unfortunately, Pedro, I have no magic wand that I can wave to make hackers of any system go away.
Yeah, every system will be gamified, you know, gamed to some degree. Yeah, I think this is a scenario where hopefully the most valuable thing that we can do, especially if you are in a remote environment, is make sure that you're working very collaboratively with a lot of, you know, tight communication feedback loops between the team, right? So that then you can look for those things as Anna said, around, you know, are they participating in meetings, you know, and is that participation match to the code that they were writing, or do they seem to maybe not be very knowledgeable about the code that they, you know, was submitted, you know, under their
are all of their code reviews LGTM?
Right. Right. Exactly. So I think, you know, some sort of classic collaborative management practices, I think, apply here and help. So let's get to into the McDougal method. You decided not to fight AI, but to design around it. So what did you do that's different than most interview approaches? Walk us through it.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that we have a shorter technical interview than most places, I think. Like, our technical interview is 90 minutes long maximum. And in that, actually only about 40 to 45 minutes is coding related. So you can imagine then, this is the way I think about it, right? As I said, I'm just getting comfortable for those who are hearing squeaks and creaks. you can imagine that, as I said, we cannot control someone's home environment. We cannot control their setup. We cannot control what tools they use. Furthermore, I think there's a growing awareness that AI is a tool for software engineers. Now, we are talking as software engineering managers, as leaders, as technical leaders, we're talking a lot about how do we train our people to use this effectively? How can we integrate this into our development tools? How do we make sure that we're not introducing, you know, bad code or insecure code by using these things? How do we get people on board? How do we upskill? We're having these conversations, and to me, what I saw was a huge mismatch between that conversation and the conversation you and I kind of just had, which is like, oh, everyone's cheating. Why are they using AI in interviews? And I'm like, well, you know, are you asking them why they're using an IDE in an interview? Like, no, you're not, because it's a tool that helps
just
them.
A tool.
Like, you know, and in the end, my thinking was, well, if you want an engineering team that uses AI effectively, then part of your technical interview process should be, can you use AI effectively when you're coding? So basically what we did is we broke down the technical interview process into four parts. And I will look at my side screen. I'm aware that I just like warned about that, but I don't want to lie to anyone. So I'm just going to look at my own notes.
I know you're real because you were already using your
hand. I already did the hand thing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing if like this whole thing was a deep fake and it was like, I'm here talking about it. That's amazing.
Actually doing three of these interviews at once. Yeah.
Look, now that, you know what I have to say though, if someone could do three interviews at the same time, like they're probably a good hire. Yeah.
Right.
So the first thing we do is a 10 to 15 minute kind of overview of the candidate and their technical history. Yeah. Where were you working? What kind of challenges did you face? What did you enjoy doing? And of course, our team also introduces themselves. Pretty standard. I don't think there's anything there that is, you know, going to be groundbreaking. But it's important to note that if we are talking about a holistic view of each candidate, and we're talking about assessing technical skills that can't be noted through AI, this is one way to do that, yeah? So what is their individual experience? How did they experience the technical challenges that they met before? And that's something that there's no right or wrong answer, you know? So I don't, like, they could, I guess, have an AI tell them what to say, but there's no right or wrong, so it's like, it doesn't actually help them one way or the other.
Right.
So that's the first thing, yeah? But the important thing here is that we wanted to keep that section really short. We say 10 to 15 minutes. The reason is, and again, I'm kind of bringing in the humanistic side here that I strongly believe in for technical interviews. The reason is people come into technical interviews terrified. Like they are terrified. Like they are so nervous. They're so worried. What if I can't solve it? What if I freeze up? What if like I make the wrong call and they judge me? Like they're so nervous, right? And I don't think, especially as managers, that, you know, we're a bit further away from that process. I don't think that people who haven't done a technical interview in maybe even 2 years or 3 years remember necessarily how terrifying they are. Like we're too far away from them now, you know? We're not good people to do that, but we have to remember that that is the primary emotion, is fear and terror. And if you know anything about the human brain and about neuropsychology or neuroscience, you know that when a person is in fight or flight mode, they cannot think and they cannot learn, right? Their brain is preoccupied with survival because it doesn't know, are you in a technical interview or are you being chased by a bear? To your body, they are the same thing. So the idea of this first stage is to calm them down, start like this, to have like a nice conversation, have a little laugh, have a smile, kind of humanize it a bit, give them a few easy questions that they know are coming about, oh, your previous work history and what are your challenges. You know, that's the nice stuff, right? But not so long that they're like, oh shit, when's the technical part gonna come? When's the technical part? Because they're also still thinking that, right? So you wanna kind of chill them out a little bit, but not stretch it out so that they're getting freaked out the longer you wait. And then you get into part two, which is kind of like the meat of the thing, which is a pair programming session. So how we did this, and I feel like this is extremely important to stress. We are thinking about how can the technical interview round mirror the real engineering work that people are doing to the closest level possible. That is the core of it. So how can we create an environment which is as close as possible to the real work that they will be doing? Because I think that's the core of it. Like these LeetCode things, I mean, I don't know. I haven't had to do like fizz buzz in my real engineering work ever. I don't think anyone does. So, you know, I just don't think it's a good indication of what people can do. I think it's a good indication of how much people can memorize. And I don't think that's necessarily what makes a great engineer. So how do people work? Well, let's imagine. What we really want to know is this candidate going to perform well when they're with us at the early stages, for example? So my thinking was, how can we create an environment that is as similar as possible to them solving one of their first tickets? And that's kind of the thinking that I have here. So what we did is we have several of them, but I'll just use singular. We created a repository that mirrors, and I'll go back to mobile engineering, mirrors our React Native application code base for one section of our application. So it's not the full application, it's not production code, it's just based on how we structure things. So same filing, same organizational convention, same naming convention, same structure, same idea. And then we create a tiny little repository around that, no APIs, no secrets, you know, just mocks. And we create this repository with 5 failing tests. So each test represents a different level that we would expect someone to be able to meet. So in this way, we imagine it to be a very similar scenario to what someone might face in their first week on the job. you come into an organization, you've never seen the code base before, there's a small bug, we don't know why this test is failing, this is your first ticket, we'll give it to you because you're new, go for it. And then you think, oh, this is a bit hard, I'll pull in another engineer to help me with my first ticket, and then you're doing pair programming. So that's kind of like the situation we're trying to mimic here. So we've got two interviewers in each technical interview. I tell them ahead of time, one of you will ask most of the questions in the kind of like question conversational parts, and the other will be the pair programming partner during the coding part. They go through the code base together. They get them to run the test. They see the tests are failing. That person has to fix them. The tests, as I said, there are five, and they kind of go, they're quite purposefully structured to address each individual level that we would expect our engineers to be able to handle. So for example, there's a junior, like fresh out of uni or training course or boot camp kind of question, junior to mid-level, so kind of starting to get a little more complex, mid-level kind of question, mid to senior, and the senior one is usually like something that is just like really verbose, kind of all over the place, and they have to do a kind of complete refactor of that function, for example. So we kind of go from there. So you can imagine the junior one being like, change the color of a button, you know. The junior to mid-level one might be like, oh yes, great, you've got a good one. Yeah, on click of it. Oh great, I've got my own examples to look at. That's perfect.
Yeah, for those watching this, this is one part of your post on Medium that I really liked, was how you laid out these different levels. And just to clarify from my understanding, so you have these as five failed tests, like automated tests, so they see that they're red instead of green, right? Mm-hmm. And then basically they work up the levels. Or do you kind of tell them specifically based on the role that they're interviewing for, go work on this one versus this one, like, you know?
Exactly, yeah. So based on what role they're interviewing for, that will change where they start. So because we've only got 45 minutes or 40 to 45 minutes, and also because it doesn't make any sense. If someone's applying to be a senior or a principal engineer, I'm not going to make them change the color of a button. It's a complete waste of their time. It's a complete waste of my time, right? So I would always start people one level below where I think the position is for. So if they're going for a mid-level, I would probably start them at level two, or maybe level one if they're on the border and I'm not 100% sure. For someone who's a senior, I would start them at level two or three. Someone senior plus, I would start them at level three. You know, you can kind of use your own judgment, but or even level four, just to kind of see how they go. If there's someone who is like, I'm a principal engineer, I've got 15 years of experience, I've worked at all the big names, blah, blah, blah. Again, my bias showing a little bit here, but then you might say, okay, let's just start them straight at level five. Let's just jump straight in and see how they do. But I think it's nice to throw them a bone and go a little bit one level before, because it gives them a kind of like an easier win first, something that's not quite as like taxing first. I'm a strong believer in like, you play to people's strengths and you give people a little confidence boost, and then they're more likely to relax and again, not feel like a bear is chasing them. So that's the basic idea, yeah, that you can also therefore get an idea of what their level is for your organization. Because someone who is a senior at one organization is not always a senior at another organization. Someone who's a junior at one organization could be more than a mid-level at another one. You know, there are lots of different levels in there. And if you only trust the CV, you will sometimes get some rude awakenings in one direction or another, actually.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. Excellent. So,
I'll keep going. Sorry. That's section two. Yeah. That's the actual pair programming part. Now, what are we actually testing here? I think that's important. This is testing delivery, right? This is testing actually like, can they do it? Right. And we tell our candidates very openly, very explicitly, you can use any tool you want here. And that's where we differ from most people. We say you can use ChatGPT, you can use Google, you can use Cursor, you can use whatever you want. Use whatever you would normally use in your work. Yeah, don't try to do something you haven't used before just because you think we're expecting it. No, just do what you normally do and show us what you do. You know, it's fine. Like, again, we're not here to test your memory. I know I could never remember like the difference between different like native JavaScript functions. I was constantly forgetting the names of things. I don't think that makes me a bad engineer. I just have a terrible memory for the names. So it's kind of like you can really get a better view of how that person actually works and what they actually deliver. Mm-hmm. But of course, I can already hear the people thinking to themselves, sure, but then are they actually the ones doing this, or is AI the one doing this? And how do we actually know if they understand what they've done? And that's actually where section 3 comes into play. And to me, section 3 is as important as section 2. And this is where the engineers will say, okay, firstly, we get them, give them a chance to reflect. How do you think you did? How do you think that went? Do you know what? The reason we do that every time is to give them a chance to kind of breathe out and like decompress a little bit, like to kind of say, okay, that part's done. You know, the technical part, that's done. Now I can breathe a little bit. And they can also tell us, you know, if nerves were really cramping their style, then they can say, I really did way worse than I thought I would do. I can't believe I forgot this part here, you know, and I had to use Google to remind myself of the function name or whatever, but I just blanked on it. You know, I'm a bit disappointed in myself, whatever. Like, they can give an honest reflection, and I think that's important. Sure. To give them a chance to justify themselves for when they do feel that they've flunked out, even when they haven't. Often people feel they have even when they haven't. Right. But more importantly, this is when the engineers, after that little decompression, then say, okay, I saw that you did this, or you went with this method. Why is that? Or let's say a GitHub Copilot suggested to you that you do this one thing and you didn't take that suggestion. Why didn't you take that suggestion? What did you think was wrong with it? You know, like, let them explain why they did or didn't use certain things from the AI, because I think that is increasingly going to be the skill that separates good engineers from bad engineers. It's like, who blindly accepts everything and who is actually like really thinking about what the AI is offering them. And also, or another way they could do it, who is accepting what AI gives them, but then really critically looking at it and saying, okay, I can improve this part, or this part that it did wasn't quite right, you know, and who's actually really intellectually engaging with what's coming at them from the AI. Because like it or not, that's how engineers are working, and right. That's what they are doing, and that's what you need to be assessing. If you're not assessing it, you're not actually assessing your engineers. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. So in that conversation, that's where we're assessing understanding. In the past, there was this conflation of the technical test, like with leak code, for example, that is testing your understanding of the code, right? That is testing your understanding and your implementation in one. But I think actually nowadays what makes more sense is to test the implementation, see how they do it, yeah, give them a chance to just focus on that, and then to talk about the understanding, talk about the why, talk about the how. Say, like, what do you think could be improved? Or what do you think you would have liked to do if you had more time? You know, these kinds of questions will give them a chance to dive deeper into how they're thinking about certain things. Or, you know, you used arrays instead of objects. Why is that? Like, was it just because AI suggested, or was there a reason that you wanted to go with that approach? So there are all sorts of different ways. Of course, different questions will change every time based on what the candidate does, which is one of the challenging things. But in that way, at least you kind of give them a chance to create something in their own way using the tools of the trade as they are now. And the very last phase, just to wrap it up, of course, is getting them to ask you questions and answering any of those questions. As always, super important that they get a chance to quiz you as much as you get a chance to quiz them. I'm going fuzzy again. Am I? There we go. but that's basically the summary, if you will, of the structure of the framework.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So definitely go read the Medium article to get more details on each of those phases. But the phase one was a candidate introduction and technical background. Mm-hmm. Phase two, pair programming, that's the heart of the method and where you're really using a lot of AI and you're encouraging that use. Phase three of reflection and follow-up questions about the coding exercise you just did. And then phase four, candidate questions and wrap up. So lots of great details about that on the Medium article. I have another viewer question here I want to make sure we get to. Ramesh asks, he says, hi, Anna. AI tools are increasingly being used by candidates to tailor resumes or prepare interview answers that align closely with job descriptions. From an interviewer's perspective, is this seen as effective preparation or could it come across as inauthentic? So a little more pre to the interview, getting into the interview, using mm-hmm. AI to help you open that door.
Yeah, to me, I see it as effective preparation. Mm-hmm. I think there's a difference between using AI to help you structure your thoughts and your experience and using AI to lie. I think those are two different things.
Right.
So if someone is using an AI to create tasks they didn't really do in a previous job to make themselves align with the job description, I think that's, you know, that's inauthentic, that's insincere, it's cheating, you know, it's not true. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not a good idea either, because at some point someone will ask you about it and you'll be stuck. But I think, for example, with me, I have a very, you know, eclectic background that combines business and tech and engineering and public speaking and writing a book and all this kind of stuff. And not all of that is relevant for every job that I will ever apply to. So if I were applying for a job and I wanted to kind of have something to put some order to all of this stuff that I've done, I don't think that it's inauthentic to plug all of that into an LLM and say, here is like a list of all the stuff I've done, like the 10-page CV version, you know,
right.
And say, cut this down, choose the absolute best examples for this job description that I can put into my CV or my cover letter. I think that is fine. I still personally would always prefer to write cover letters myself, and I really dislike reading AI generated cover letters. I say AI generated because I think there's place for AI to correct mm-hmm. writing, you know, especially for non-native speakers. You know, I think it's a very useful tool to help you, you know, actually express yourself properly. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I think letting it write the draft for you, it will sound exactly the same as every other cover letter, you know, that is AI generated, and it won't sound like you. So I do think you should write your own first and, you know, maybe just use it to edit grammar or spelling or things like that. But in terms of bringing order to chaos, that's one of the things LLMs are excellent for. And I think you can absolutely use it that way.
Yeah, I would say in coding as well as resume writing and you know, maybe in most things that we would use AI for, we should be using it as a coach more than a generator in a lot of ways, right? So helping you realize which part of your resume, you know, doesn't address this key thing that was in the job description, for example, but not letting it completely rewrite your resume necessarily, or at least not, you know, making sure you go back and read that and make sure it didn't hallucinate something into your resume that you didn't actually do, right?
Exactly.
You know, one other comment here I want to share back from Andres again, because this is interesting to me. He says how he'll ask candidates about using AI, and he's surprised how often they say they don't always use it, even when we kind of assume that's not true. This reminded me of, I was at a seminar recently where someone was talking about encouraging a good way to encourage the use of AI in your teams as an engineering leader. And she made an interesting point to me of how people are sometimes afraid to admit that they use AI for fear of it making them appear to be lazy or less knowledgeable or less confident or whatever. And so as engineering managers, if we want our teams to leverage efficiency boosts from this, we need to model that behavior ourselves so that they know it's okay. You know, if I, as the boss,
say,
I'm using it, right? So, yeah, so this is kind of a, you know, Andres's comment here is kind of a good illustration to me, but something I really like about your method here is that by modeling the use of AI and encouraging it, you're kind of encouraging people to be more transparent about how they're using it and how they're thinking.
Yeah, and inside teams, I think this is also important. So one thing that I did is I took like I just did like a quick little Slack message saying like, who can everyone in my team just tell me how you're using AI for coding at the moment? And it ranged from people who were using it for almost everything to people who weren't using it at all. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I went to the person who said, I'm using it for almost everything. And I said, great, you're going to show everyone how you're using it. And they actually then ran a session for the team kind of saying, okay, look, here's a function here. Let's say I want to change this. I want to change the structure of it. This is how I can use it using, we use GitHub. So using the GitHub Copilot agent mode. And here's how you can like enter in what you need. And here you can see where the changes were made. And here you can track, you know, what was changed and, you know, accept or reject changes or whatever. And he kind of like walked us all through that, which was great. And everyone really appreciated that. And I think there were two members of my team who didn't yet have the Copilot installed locally. And so then they then contacted me immediately after that session to ask me for access and, you know, so they could get it and start using it. And I was like, awesome, you know. And we're going to do that like every 2 months at the moment. The plan is to kind of do a little session like that because it's changing so much, and kind of rotate through different people to kind of see how they've, to give practical examples of how they've used it. So I think, yeah, modeling that and kind of showing not only that you're open to it, but that you're encouraging it, I think is very important for management. I've just realized it's getting very dark because there's a storm coming. I'm just going to turn my light on. If you can still hear me, go, please keep
going. Oh, yeah,
going.
No problem. So, yeah, so I think another viewer comment I want to get to here. Umkar asks, how good is it to integrate AI conversational agents for pre-screening?
Terrible.
What I terrible. So to clarify what I believe Omkar is asking here, for those who may not be familiar, this would be the idea of, you know, a challenge we haven't discussed is that you might get hundreds of submissions on an open job posting.
Yeah.
And you may not know how many of those themselves are real people, are bots, are people who are qualified for the position, or maybe people who are just sort of spam cannon applying to lots of roles that they may or may not be suitable for. Mm-hmm. And so rather than sorting through hundreds of applicants yourself, using some sort of a bot to help you pre-screen down to who you should actually talk to. So I think that's the concept, I assume, Omkar is talking mm-hmm. about here. But Anna, you definitively said terrible. So tell me more.
Okay. I mean, as with everything, it's not that clear cut, but in general, I think it's a bad idea. And this is the reason why I think it's a bad idea. I think it starts off as like, okay, we'll just take people whose, I don't know, salary expectation is within our range. And then we'll just narrow it down to people who are located in our country or whatever it is that your hiring criteria is. Right. And I think if you only used it that way ever, it would be fine, but then you're basically just using the same kind of filters that you could use on a spreadsheet. Like, you don't actually need AI to do that. What I see AI doing is often amplifying biases. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said terrible, because I think a lot of AI systems would, and you know, maybe this is my own personal bias speaking, but would look at my CV and would say, she doesn't have a computer science degree, you know, she doesn't like have 15 years as a senior engineer, which most of our good hires in the past, as like, let's say it's a, I don't know, a VP engineering or a CTO role, most of our CTOs or VPs in the past have 15 years of experience in this field before they move into management. She didn't have that. So therefore she's not going to be a good candidate and I would get screened out. Doesn't matter that I've written books or that I'm you know, a thought leader on this stuff. It doesn't matter that like I have the experience or the drive or the intellect or whatever. It doesn't matter. Not all of that is erased because I don't tick the boxes that previous success stories have.
Yeah.
I think there's still something to be said for systems, for humans to actually pick up on talent or potential. And I think that's what LLMs are not good at, is this concept of potential. And in my experience, the best hires that you make are people who aren't already doing the job you're hiring them for. They're people who are just one little step under the job you're hiring them for, usually, because you are then growing them by them stepping into that. They're highly invested into growing into that role. So often when LLMs pull out you know, who they think the best candidates are, you will often find them, you know, going for the ex-FANG companies, going for the good schools, going for the years of experience. And those three things are not actually the best indicator of talent or of potential. So I think it's a bad idea.
Okay. Well, Amkar says superb. Thank you. So we're over time, but we're getting some great questions. And this one I want to, we've kind of really been talking about how to structure the interview process. Afzal asks, hey, Anna, any suggestions for the interviewees, for the interview subjects? So let's say that they're, you know, if they're going through one of your interview processes, sure. What would you tell them in order to be most successful at that?
Oh, I mean, it's hard. I hate giving this kind of advice because, like, it always sounds so cliche, like, oh, try to relax and right. just be yourself, you know? And it's like, oh, like, I can hear how terrible it sounds, you know? But at the same time, they really are the best pieces of advice that I can give. Okay. I would say that, yeah, don't use tools that you don't normally use. Like, use a system mm-hmm. or a system that you would normally use in your own development. So don't try to do something new and fancy or whatever just to please the interviewers. Like, if you're hearing, oh, like, if I tell you we accept AI tools, that doesn't mean you have to use an AI tool. If you come in and you don't want to use even autocomplete, power to you. Like, go for right. it. Like, we're not here to judge, like, to judge that is your best skill or whatever. Like, we want to see how you develop. We want to see how you think and why you solve problems in the way you solve problems. So I would say that's the first thing. Don't do things just to impress us, because right. it usually backfires. We can normally sense that something's not quite right. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to practice. Like, I do have a book. If you're already in tech, it's not for you. So probably for most people here, it's not relevant. It's about getting into tech and it's about that. But I have to admit, there's a lot of good advice in there for people of any level. And the third section is divided into three parts. And the third part is all about interviews. And one of the things I stress in there is to record yourself on video talking about code, solving a code problem out loud with your mouth moving, because so many people, they practice by doing, for example, leak code questions or coding by themselves. Then suddenly they have to explain their thinking to another human being in a technical interview, and they can't do it. You know, they can't think out loud as they're typing. It's a skill. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a skill to be able to explain what you're thinking and what you're doing as you do it with your mouth open. And it's not an easy skill. And I would recommend practicing it with yourself, just talking to yourself or a friend if you can find one, and then watching it back, which yeah. I know everyone hates doing.
It's painful, yeah.
I know, but it's honestly the best thing you can do. That's yeah. the truth of the matter.
Absolutely. And that book that you're referring to is You Belong in Tech, for those yes. who may want to look it up. So, Anna, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate it. And thank you also to everyone watching for your excellent questions. Anna, do you have any closing thoughts that you want to share? And how can our listeners learn more about your work or get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest way to find me. I have a very old, outdated website, but I told Aaron not to display it because it's so bad and I'm really embarrassed that it still exists. But it's there if you really want to go. It's annamcdougall.com if you want to get in touch with me with a contact form. That's where you find the contact form. That's the only thing it's good for, is the contact form. But yeah, I think overall, I just want to say, like, we can build new systems. You know, we don't have to rely on old ways of doing things. AI is a tool. We can use it in a positive way. And I just think, be open to trying things. Like, try it out. Build a sample repository that mirrors the work you really do. Throw someone into it and kind of see how they go. And I think you'll get a much better idea through that of who can really work in your code base and who's just good at memorization. So I think that's the key for me. So try it and then let me know how it goes. That's the other thing. I would love to get feedback.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Anna. That Medium article, again, if you want to look it up, is called You Can't Outrun AI in Tech Interviews. So we designed around it. Anna McDougal, thank you so much for taking the time to explain all of this to us today. It was a really wonderful conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. All right. Thank you again for joining us today and in this episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. For our viewers, if your team could use some help finding top-tier software development and technical talent in Latin America, check out the technical staffing services of our sponsor, AgilityFeet, at agilityfeet.com. And this conversation will be archived on the Scaling Tech Podcast YouTube channel. To learn more about other episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast, be sure to follow us on YouTube and the podcast platform of your choice, as well as visiting scalingtechpod.com. Thanks again for joining us today on the Scaling Tech Podcast.